I'm reading from 1 Samuel chapter 30, and I'll stop at I think. Now it happened, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire, and had taken captive the women and those that were with, that were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire, and their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, "Please bring the ephod here to me." And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them?" And he answered him, "Pursue, for you shall surely overtake them, and without fail recover all." So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook of Besor. Then they found an Egyptian in the field, and brought him to David. And they gave him bread, and he ate. And they let him drink water, and they gave him a piece of a cake of figs, and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. Then David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I felt sick. We made an invasion of the southern area of the Kerethites in the territory which belongs to Judah, and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." And David said to him, "Can you take me down to this troop?" So he said, "Swear to me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this troop." And when he had brought him down, there they were, spread out over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. Then David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Then David took all the flocks and herds they had driven before those other livestock and said, "This is David's spoil." Now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they also had made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart." But David said, "My brethren, you shall not so do with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike." So it was. From that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day.
Have you ever noticed how life seems to be full of problems? You deal with one, then comes another. You say that about buses, don't we? But the difference between a bus and a problem is that you don't need to wait for problems because they're in fairly constant and ready supply. David has dealt with Saul as a problem. He's dealt with the problem of, does he fight with the Philistines or does he not? And that problem has been dealt with. The box is ticked, sorted. And then he returns back home and finds that his city has been burned. His family, the women and the children, have been carried off. And now he has another big problem. I'm minded of Amos chapter 5 and verse 19. "It will be as though a man fled from a lion and a bear met him. Or as though he went into the house and leaned his hand on the wall and a serpent bit him." I can imagine this man whom Amos imagines seeing a lion, and he runs away from a lion, and there's a bear. And he runs away from a bear, and he gets home, and he bolts the door, and he thinks, "I'm safe now," and then he's bitten by a snake. He can't get away from the troubles of life, and neither can David. He has enemies in Israel, enemies in Philistia, and now the Amalekites have showed their hand, as they are wont to do. In verses 1 to 6, we have some of David's problems. So the Amalekites had invaded. That wouldn't normally be a problem for David. He's a great warrior. He has something of an army. But if you invade while the army is away, they attacked Ziklag and they burned it with fire. They didn't have to do that. They could have just invaded and taken what they wanted, but they burned it with fire. They want to make a point. They took captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They carried them away into slavery. And when the men came back, what's their reaction? They lifted up their voices, in verse 4, and they wept. These are tough men. It's not often that tough men weep, not publicly. I'm sure they do in private all the time. But these men are weeping until they had no power to weep. Have you ever cried until there are no tears left? These men have no tears left. They've used them up. Weeping for their children, weeping for their wives, weeping for their friends. Now David has two wives. Much good it did him because they've both gone. And David's problems are compounded in verse 6 because he is being blamed. For the people spoke of stoning him because the soul of all the people was grieved. Can you remember that early chapter when we first looked at the life of David? and Goliath's on the battlefield, and David is bringing his cheeses. And he's accused of wickedness, and the young lad says, What have I done? He's no longer a young lad carrying cheese, but he's a young man carrying the blame of all those hurting people. You see, these men are so upset, they need someone to blame. They might have blamed the Amalekites if they thought about it, but they want to blame David. After all, who's in charge? Who brought us to this place? Who took us off to the Philistines when we weren't even needed? It's his fault. And in their grief, they want to stone him. The Bible says, in your anger, do not sin. Don't make decisions or apportion blame when you're grief-stricken. David's troubles continue to pile up. But in the previous chapter, was he not delivered? Yes, he was. And maybe David is thinking, Lord, why did you deliver me from that problem for me to go and run into another one? And we find that too. You see, God has not promised us an easy life. But he has promised us strength and grace with which to face it. However, David has grown spiritually. And it's often through the difficulties and the trials of life through which we grow and our faith develops and strengthens. I went walking a year ago at Cocker Sands Abbey. It's really quite a bleak place, if I'm honest. And the winds there are so strong that the trees have been misshaped by it. So even on a day where there's no wind, which are probably few and far between in that place, the trees look like they're blowing in the wind. But I went up to one and I touched it. Let me tell you, it was hard as iron. It didn't sway. It wouldn't break. Any pressure I put upon it was nothing compared to that wind. You show me a Christian who's gone through tough times. You show me a Christian who's had trials, and I'll show you a Christian that with the grace of God can withstand the tempest. And David is a man being trained for kingship. And God knew that while he was on the parade ground with the Philistines, God knew the Amalekites were attacking from behind. It did not take God by surprise. But God not only knew that the Amalekites were attacking, he also knew that at the end of this chapter, David would be stronger and wiser. And here we have the evidence of it still in that sixth verse. So in the very verse in which the people are speaking of stoning him, we're told, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. He could have strengthened himself in his reputation or his cleverness or his potential regal authority. But he doesn't. Psalm 37 and verse 39 says, but the salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. He is their strength in time of trouble. You know, each of us contains some strength. There are people out there who don't believe in God and they have difficulties and they can overcome them. I believe we as humans do have some strength. But I'm glad that the paltry strength I have is not all I have access to. I have the strength of heaven. There are resources available to every Christian which the world can neither see nor understand. They'll never let you go. Notice that the writer says, but David strengthened himself in the Lord, his God. David no longer has a city. He no longer has a home. He no longer has a loyal army. He doesn't even have wives anymore, but he still has his God. And when everything else has been taken away, he still has his God. And therefore, he still has his strength. The writer here is talking of that personal relationship which David has with God. You know, if I were to ask you about, you know, the Lord being a shepherd, you would think of Psalm 23, and quite rightly. But also in Psalm 80, God is called the shepherd of Israel. But in Psalm 23, David says, the Lord is my shepherd. The Lord is God. The Lord is my God. And if you believe, the Lord is your God. God is not just a being in the sky about whom you can know and have opinions. He is someone you can know. He's someone you can talk to. He's someone you can love. He's someone you can trust. David strengthened himself in the Lord, his God. Paul writes in the second chapter of the Galatians, talking of Christ, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. You know, the Christian faith is not just philosophy and theology. We've come today not to hear me deliver some kind of lecture on some theory. It's about being intimate with the God of heaven. It's about what we sang in that last hymn. When Adam and Eve were in Eden and the Lord their God walked in the garden calling for them. That's the relationship we have with God. Sin, of course, ruins that relationship and it separates and it tarnishes and it spoils. But in Christ, that relationship with God is restored. Human beings can once again have fellowship with God at the tree of life. David has developed spiritually also in verse 7. Previously, he's made up his own mind to flee to the Philistines. Not so in verse 7. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. Ah. Now David wants to know what God would have him do, not just what David would have himself do. You see, if you're finding your strength in the Lord your God, you have to do things his way and not your way. You do things your way, then I hope you've got the strength to see it through. But do things God's way. And let me tell you, friends, he will supply. And he will provide. And he will prepare the way. Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? You know, it really is the logical and the obvious thing to do. I mean, what's the alternative? Well, we won't overtake them. We'll just wait for more wives to come along. That clearly isn't an option. And yet now David is saying, even though that appears to be the obvious option, I will not proceed except God give his approval. Because they that build labour in vain, except the Lord build the house. He answered them, pursue. For you shall surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him. They came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. Why are they so weary? Well, they've ridden 60 miles from Aphek to Ziklag. I get tired driving a car. You know, these men are tired. That's okay. Can I also say, though, that their grief has wearied them? Says Psalm 119, my soul is weary with sorrow. Strengthen me according to your word. Grief does weary. Sorrow will drain your strength. But the God of heaven, through his word, will supply all your needs, abundantly so. From verse 11 to 15, we have again God's providence. Now, providence, as we've explained previously, is when God uses circumstances and events which are not obviously the hand of God, whereby his will and his purposes can be achieved. I remember once, a long time ago, before I came here, I was looking for a church. And I'd prayed, you know, I'd been to a few, you know, one was like the Wacky Warehouse, one was as dead as an undertaker's. I thought, there must be something in between. And I prayed, I didn't know the area, and I got lost in a town. I got lost in a town, and I stopped at some traffic lights thinking, where now? And I looked and there was a church. And that's the church I went to. Now, no one is telling me that that wasn't the providence of God. God allowed me to get lost in a town that I might find the church to which he was drawing me. And here we have, from verse 11, an Egyptian in a field. What's so unusual about that? Well, they're not in Egypt, for a start. And this Egyptian, I don't think he's doing anything in the field. The text doesn't quite say it, but I'm almost certain he is laying down, perhaps semi-conscious or unconscious. And this Egyptian is a slave. And he's been left behind by his master, who is an Amalekite. You see, the Amalekite does not care for his Egyptian slave. He's about to die. Well, if I just leave him in the field, it'll save the trouble of having to bury him. And after all, we've just attacked Ziklag. I've got many more where he came from. I don't need him anymore. And God used the selfishness of that man to be his own undoing, and for David to recoup that which was lost. They gave him bread and he ate. They let him drink water. They gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins, high energy food. When he had eaten, his strength came back to him. That's interesting. He's now the second person in this chapter to whom strength has been restored. This man's needs were physical, and God, through David, provides it with these raisins and fig cake. David's strength was spiritual. He had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. He's close to dying. He's nearly a corpse. But David got to him just in time. Was that lucky? No, it was the providence of God. In verse 13, David asks him who he belongs to, and this young man explains that he's been left behind and left to die. However, he also provides David with all the information he needs about the attack. Where they came from, what they took, where they went. We burn Ziklag with fire. And David and the Egyptian do a deal. The Egyptian says, well, I'll lead you to them. I know where they are. But don't hand me back over to that man who left me to die. David said to him, "Can you take me down to this troop?" What if David saw the Egyptian in the field and thought, "Bah, just another slave, so what? We'll carry on without him." No. I believe that, and it might be that David thought he might know information, but remember, he probably looks dead. The mercy that David showed to this young man was the means by which he would have all the information he needs to recover those stolen people. Always show mercy, even when you're busy. Always make time for that insignificant person, that nobody, that person of no account, that person who cannot pay you back, because let me tell you, friends, what you do for the least of my brethren, you do for me. From verses 16 to 20, having been blessed by God's providence, having found the strength from God, he gets the victory. And in verse 16, David interrupts their party. They're celebrating. It's been a day well spent. And when he had brought him down, that's the Egyptian, there they were, spread out over all the land. They're no longer in a defensive position. They're quite safe. Who can attack us now? Eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. My, these Amalekites have been busy. You see, they've been keeping an eye on what's been going on between the Philistines and the Israelites. These people are clever. You see, if the Israelites are attacking the Philistines and the Philistines attacking the Israelites, who's defending their land? Here's a perfect opportunity, guys, for us to go and help ourselves. And they were right. Let's attack both of them while they're busy attacking each other. They've robbed two of their more powerful neighbours and got away with it. And let's face it, one of the either Philistines or the Israelites will win this war. The other will be too weak to chase the Amalekites to get the possessions back. And the victorious side will probably be too busy spoiling the loser. They are quids in. That is until verse 17. In verse 17, they meet a man called David. We're told he attacked them from twilight until evening of the next day. 400 of them managed to escape on camels. I don't know if I presume the writer did not intend that to be humorous, but I smiled when I read it. It sounds quite funny. And we're told that David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. He rescued that which was his and that which belonged to all the others. Nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters. Why hadn't the Amalekites killed them? Because they wanted to sell them or to use them. Their greed actually was a degree of mercy. And it was their greed which meant they were still alive by the time David came. David recovered all. Now, where have I heard that before? Ah, yeah, that's what God said. God fulfills his word. When David first heard that, when the ephod was being utilized, maybe he doubted it. I mean, surely we'll get some of it back. Maybe most of it at a push, but all of it? When God says all, he means all. David recovered all. And David took all the flocks and herds that they had driven before those other livestock and said, "This is David's spoil." Not only does David take back that which was taken from him, but I think he takes back the other things beside. He's now richer than he was in the previous chapter. And he takes that which has been robbed from Judah. You know, God allows us sometimes to be lowered Not only is it a wonderful platform for his grace to lift us back up and restore us, but it's also a testing of our heart. Let me also say, though, that God is in the business of testing our hearts, not only when we are made low, but sometimes when we are lifted high. The story does not end in verse 20. There is another test for David from verse 21. He's victorious on the battlefield. He's richer than he's ever been before. And so in verse 21, now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they had also made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. So he's got 400 men. There were 200 left behind because they were too weary to continue crossing the brook and to engage in battle. And David has with him their possessions and their wives and their children. In verse 22 we're told, then all the wicked and worthless men of those who were with David answered and said, wicked and worthless men. Oh, but come, come. These are the followers of David. Yep. Even the followers of David can be wicked and worthless. And so they come up with a point. Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. They're wicked and worthless because of their greed. They're almost aping the very Amalekites who previously had robbed them. And their plan is, you know, if you weren't in the battle, we will give you back your wife and your children, but, you know, clear off. Everything else of yours that was lost, well, that belongs to us now, because after all, we worked very hard to get it back. All you were doing was sleeping and recovering. Do they have a good point? Are these 200 nothing but scroungers and layabouts? Well, the writer makes it absolutely clear that these men are wicked and worthless before they even come up with this clever argument. David's army, of course, is made up of disgruntled types. In defeat, they were noble enough, except when they tried to lure him into killing Saul. But now they've been elevated and they're victorious. It's become apparent what they're like. You know, I said before that sometimes when we're made low, you see what people are really like, and God sees what your faith is made of, and sometimes when we're made high, the same thing. Now, are there people out there who, if they were suddenly to come into money, would you see what they're really like? They dwell in different circles now. Now these men have got money. Their wickedness, like all scum, has come to the surface. And it puts David in a difficult position. You see, there are 400. Well, presumably not all of them are wicked and worthless, but they are a part of the 400. And the minority, the 200, you know, if you want to keep most people happy most of the time, you probably go along with what they just said. But doing the right thing often makes you unpopular. David says, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. Notice how David gives the glory to God. Yeah, we fought, but it's God who gave victory. Yes, we pursued, but it's God who gave them into our hands. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. So it was from that day forward. He made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. That's good military planning. If you're leading an army, you have supply wagons and you need people to defend them. Because if you're an army on the march and your supply wagons have been pilfered, you starve. That means you lose the war. And therefore, those who look after the supplies are just as integral a part of the army as those who fight. Those who go out delivering leaflets and those who stay behind and pray are both integral parts of the army. In fact, David's being generous because they weren't guarding the supplies because there weren't any. That was the problem. They'd been robbed. But it's a sound principle he establishes all the same. Notice also that when David says, what the Lord has given us, when you understand and realize that wealth is from the Lord, it's very hard to hoard it. When you realize that the good things you have been given to you by God, it's much easier to part with it. So it was from that day he made it a statute. In other words, safer, sounder, more powerful David in the future was affected and determined by weaker, smaller David in this chapter. God is training up a really, really great king. And it happens here at the Brook of Besor when an argument develops between 200 and 400 people. In verses 26 to the end of the chapter, we're told that David came to Ziklag. He sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. He gave some to those in Bethel, in Ramoth of the south, Jattir, those who were in Eroah, Sifmoth, it goes on. And in verse 31, to those who were in Hebron and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. Do you remember David used to be, you know, lurking in the fields and the caves, and he wanted the people there to support him? Well, now he's paying them back. Let me share with you a proverb. A proverb. He who gives to the poor lends to the Lord. These towns and cities gave to David, and he couldn't repay. But now he repays. You give money to those who can't pay you back. Let me tell you, their maker can more than compensate for your losses. Here he shows generosity to Israel. Are, though, the Amalekites the enemies of the Lord? Here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. Are they the enemies of the Lord? Well, let me say they are. Because, friends, if you attack the sheep, you make an enemy of the shepherd. This battle, I believe, is a part of a larger cosmic battle between good and evil, those for God and those against him. Those towards the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Let's just have a few moments to think.